abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It is Monday, February 17, 2014, and we are talking U.S. presidents today with my guest, Ivan Eland. Ivan Eland is a senior fellow and director of the Center on Peace and Liberty at the Independent Institute, independent.org. He holds a Ph.D. in national security policy from George Washington University. He's the author of numerous books, most recently, The Failure of Counterinsurgency, Why Hearts and Minds Are Seldom Won, and the book we're going to be discussing today, Recarving Rushmore, Ranking the Presidents on Peace, Prosperity, and Liberty. That book is from 2008, and Ivan tells me that in May, that book will be updated to include a chapter on Barack Obama. So, Ivan Eland, thanks so much for being here today to talk about the presidents with us.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
Now, this book of yours, Recarving Rushmore, was a project that I'm pretty sure you'll agree needed to be done a long time ago, and you actually did it. So this is a very important service for all of us, what you've done. Now, today, of course, is an appropriate day to be thinking about the presidents and ranking them and so forth, but I want to hone in on maybe some of the more controversial ones or more controversial judgments you've made, because where would be the fun in doing it any other way? So I want to start off right off the bat, if I may, just first by asking you the question that you probably got in a lot of media interviews, which is, let's say you had to give your three best and three worst presidents. Give the listeners a sense of where you're coming from by telling us who those would be.
Well, some of the best, I think, are John Tyler, Grover Cleveland, Martin Van Buren would be the top three. And as we go up from the worst, Woodrow Wilson, most of the, I think, the war presidents are probably the worst. Woodrow Wilson is the absolute worst, and then people like Harry Truman and Harry Truman for a lot of reasons. William McKinley, they're all down there. James Polk, people who started unnecessary wars, etc. I don't know if I've got that order quite right at the bottom there because I don't have the book in front of me. But those are some of the worst presidents, and Woodrow Wilson is the worst.
Well, Woodrow Wilson is the worst. All right. There's a lot to talk about in just the list you gave, but let's focus it on that. What makes Woodrow Wilson worse than FDR or worse than Truman or whatever? What's so bad? I can't believe this. You understand this is not quite a rhetorical question, but it's meant for elaboration. What's so bad about Woodrow Wilson?
Well, I think people focused on FDR as having vastly expanded the government. He certainly did, but Woodrow Wilson really set the precedent. And many people, many libertarians and others, don't focus on the fact that war is the biggest cause of a big government in human history and also in U.S. history. And certainly, permanent big government got started under Woodrow Wilson because FDR brought back many of the same people, just changed the agencies that were created, the names of them, etc. And the plan of a war-type economy was transferred into the New Deal, and FDR even said he was doing that. So I think this type of command economy was first patented by Wilson during World War One, and World War One was a totally unnecessary war for the United States. The United States had stayed out of most of Europe's wars up until that point. And certainly if Germany would have won that war, the boundaries would have just been redrawn a few 100 miles east or west, and that would have been it. But, of course, the United States changed the war, and, of course, then Woodrow Wilson let the Allies tromp all over Germany after the war, declaring them the villain for the war, which was caused by many things. And actually, there's a new book out that just is saying, and others have said this before, that perhaps Russia and Serbia were more to blame for before the war than Germany. But anyway, Woodrow Wilson also helped lead to the abdication of the Kaiser. He demanded that, and that, of course, with the depression after the war in Germany, and the reparations, heavy reparations that Wilson allowed the two allies, Britain and France, to extract from Germany. Of course, all that led to Hitler, World War II, and also, I would argue, the Depression after World War I. So, and really after the Cold War, because Wilson invaded with Britain and France, Russia, and of course, what was then the Soviet Union. And of course, that really led to hostility with the Soviet Union for a long time to come. So you could even blame the Cold War and Soviet Union on Wilson, since the U.S. entry into the war caused the Russian government to stay in the war, leading to the Bolshevik Revolution. Lenin said, "Without World War I, we would have never taken power in the Soviet Union." So you can blame a lot on Wilson. In fact, and he's still ruined the 20th century, and he's now still working on the 21st, because, of course, the Iraq War, Iraq became a country after the fall of the Ottoman Empire, and it was divided by the colonial powers. And that's one of the legacies of the war, is that Wilson knew that there was a plan to divide the world after the war between Britain and France, and he went ahead and supported the war because he wanted the U.S. to play in the post-war settlement.
All right, let's shift gears and talk about a decent president then, just to balance the scales a bit. You mentioned in your list Martin Van Buren, and I was persuaded of this myself after I heard Jeff Hummel give a paper on this subject in the late 1990s, and I thought, okay, he's made a pretty good case for a president I'm sure many Americans haven't even heard of. What's so great about Martin Van Buren?
Well, I think, and he is a big proponent of Van Buren, and I think rightly so, because he says that, and he's certainly more of a banking expert than I am, but he says that, and I would agree with him just looking at it from a more cursory point of view, that this was the best banking system that the U.S. had ever had under Van Buren. And Van Buren, Andrew Jackson, who was Van Buren's mentor, he talked the talk about, liberty and, not centralizing power or something, but Andrew Jackson was a centralizer, and he did a lot of unconstitutional things, even in trying to get rid of the bank, the Second Bank of the United States, which he successfully did. He did it sort of unconstitutionally. Martin Van Buren, on the other hand, he really walked the walk of liberty that Jackson talked, and he was for really small government and this banking system that was superior to anything we've ever had before, since it was based on more of a free market approach to things. And certainly there was a big recession during Van Buren's time, and he patented the idea that the market would eventually correct, which it did. So, and he took a big hit politically. So many of my top presidents, they didn't get reelected or even renominated because, in some cases, because of the courageous stances that they took against expanding government and the expanding executive branch. And Martin Van Buren was also for a restrained executive within the limits of the Constitution, whereas Andrew Jackson, his predecessor, was. And I think that's really a key of the book, is that you can't really judge people by their party labels or by their rhetoric, because their policies often differ from that. So you have to look at the policies, and that's what my book does. It tries to avoid the pitfalls of historians. And historians on the left and historians on the right surprisingly come up with the same best and worst presidents. My book differs from that because it really tries to not get duped by charismatic presidents like Teddy Roosevelt or activist presidents like Woodrow Wilson or FDR, which everyone thinks are good. And also, of course, the last category that historians get duped by is if you're a president during wartime, you get big points, even if you caused the war or did nothing to stop it. So it's a different sort of criteria for rating the president. president
right.
than usual.
Historians are not interested in presidents who are just humbly executing the laws. You have to have some type of broad program, domestic or international. I mean, Jeff Hummel likes Van Buren also, not only because of the independent treasury, which came as close to the separation of bank and state as we've ever had, and then for 20 years afterward, other than the fairly mild panic of 1857, you had a pretty stable monetary system, but also, he says, because he avoided wars with Britain and Mexico.
So this,
of course, explains
and
why
John Tyler also avoided a couple wars as well, and that those two presidents are sort of parallel.
Tell us something about Tyler. I wanted to ask you to follow up on Tyler.
Well, it's the same sort of thing. I mean, he actually didn't get renominated by his own party because at the time the Democratic Party was the party of small government, and the Whigs were the forerunner of the Republican Party, the party of big government. And John Tyler was a Whig. But he was only a Whig because the Whig Party started in part because the people were opposed to the imperial rule of Jackson. And so he was just kind of anti-Jackson, but he was still sort of a Democrat at heart. And so he was, limiting the government, stayed within the bounds. Now, he did make no president is perfect. And I think Tyler, one of the things that he did was he sort of annexed Texas. Using somewhat unconstitutional means, but if you go through all presidents, there's always something in their past that isn't perfect, and Tyler's certainly not perfect, but I think he's probably the best that we have given what he did. And of course, because he fought the big government programs that Henry Clay and all these other people, Whigs of his own party, were trying to institute, he ran afoul of the party bureaucracy, and everyone hated him. And he had no support from the Democrats because he wasn't a Democrat. So, of course, it was kind of a suicide mission on his part. But nonetheless, he did it anyway, and he certainly was a principled sort of president.
Just to situate these presidents, I'm sure we have an educated audience and so forth, but not everybody off the top of his head will know. So I'll just say, when we talk about Martin Van Buren, we're talking about 1836, the election of 1836. And then with Tyler, he comes in as vice president in 1840, and then very, very shortly thereafter takes over as president. All right, I want to talk to you about the one that a president who is a real lightning rod for libertarians in particular, because some of them have a kind of sympathy for him, and yet others just have no patience for him whatsoever, and you probably know who I mean. I'm not talking about Lincoln, actually. I'm talking about Ronald Reagan. Because when I was growing up in the 1980s, I was very drawn to Reagan because I liked his entrepreneurial rhetoric. I liked that he didn't apologize for the free market system. I thought that he was right that under Carter, there had been a retreat from the kind of moral certainty of the free society over communism, and he was, come what may, he was going to tell the truth about the communist system. And I liked that. This was a robust American and so on and on. Now, that was back when, okay, I was just entering adolescence. You know, you can sort of understand that. But what are the drawbacks of Reagan from your point of view that you talk about in this book?
Well, I think that Reagan was mostly rhetoric. I mean, he ruled California the way he ruled when he was president, and that is his policies were much less libertarian than his rhetoric. And also, I think he was very bad on, the setting the climate where a nuclear war almost happened, a crisis that almost rivaled the Cuban Missile Crisis, not quite as bad, but his rhetoric, overheated rhetoric against the Soviet Union, really does matter, and that's where rhetoric really does matter. And what you had there was the United States did and NATO did a nuclear command and control exercise called Able Archer in 1983. The Soviets were so scared by Reagan's rhetoric that Andropov put the Soviet nuclear forces on alert. And I think this actually sobered up Reagan a bit, and I think that's why he was one of the reasons he was so prone, and to his credit, I think, to negotiate with Mikhail Gorbachev eventually. But the other problem that I have with Reagan is his rhetoric. I mean, actually, Bill Clinton and Eisenhower reduced the government per capita, and government spending, he increased it. And contrary to his rhetoric, he also had what I would call fraudulent tax cuts. He focused on the individual tax rates, and he increased spending at the same time. Well, if you do that, you're going to have to raise taxes in the future at some point, which Ronald Reagan did like probably four or five times. Surreptitiously in other less visible parts of the tax code. And he also, you have to pay a lot of interest in the meantime. Well, or you have to print money, which is even worse. So I think, and of course, George W. Bush picked up on Reagan's tax cuts. The tax cuts were the most important, whereas actually I think reducing spending is much more important than rolling up debt like that. And so we have, that was a problem. The other problem, the third problem, I think, was the Iran-Contra thing, which I believe is the worst political scandal in American history. You have corruption scandals like Harding and Grant had, but they were mainly cabinet members sticking money in their pockets, which is certainly not good for good government. But the Watergate and Iran-Contra stand out as constitutional scandals, and I think that Iran-Contra was even worse than Watergate simply because they ran a secret war. Congress had told them not to do it, and they did it anyway, and they went around Congress's appropriation power. And of course, that's one of the few remaining powers that Congress really has after you stripped away the war power, which has been stripped away over time. And so I think that was a very serious problem. He also broke criminal laws by selling arms to terrorist-supporting nation, Iran, to try to ransom hostages, which is always a bad idea. To ransom any sort of hostages. And his rhetoric was, of course, much different on all three of these issues than his actual policies. So I think his policies leave a lot to be desired.
Now, there's one other president I want to talk about, but before we get to him, I'd like to get your judgment on where you think historians, obviously not yourself, you disagree with historians about the ranking of the presidents, but the mainstream of the profession, where do you think they're going to wind up ranking Obama? In the sense that, today I know there is still left over some enthusiasm for him that when you look back on it soberly 50 years from now won't be present. So just looking at it dispassionately, just looking at his actual record, not the excitement, not the speeches, not the rhetoric, but looking at his actual record, where do you think he winds up? Because you could say Obamacare had some serious problems with it to the point that a lot of Democrats acknowledge that. You could say that the economy stayed really bad. But on the other hand, if he manages to make peace with Iran, that secures him a spot in the history books. How do you sort all this out?
Well, also, I think he'll have positive accomplishments in ending Iraq and also ending Afghanistan eventually. I think the historians will probably focus on that rather than his interim escalation of that war for no reason. Now, I would, of course, rate him similar to Bush, maybe a few improvements in getting rid of torture and getting out of Iraq and that sort of thing. But, of course, he also had some drawbacks from Bush, the Libyan war, expanding Bush's drone war to various countries unconstitutionally. So I think, I wouldn't rate him that highly a president, but historians may, they like activist presidents. They have a bias towards activist presidents, so he may fare better in history for getting out of Iraq, cleaning up Bush's mess, so to speak. The way Gerald Ford might be rated more highly than he should be because, after all, he made the nation feel good again, but I would say at the expense of rule of law by pardoning Richard Nixon unconstitutionally before he was convicted of any crime. So that's the same situation you are with Obama and Bush. Bush left a big, a lot of legacy of war, bad economy, profligate spending on domestic and war spending, massive deficits, that sort of thing. And, Obama may get some credit for cleaning that up by historians, but certainly will probably be overrated because I think he may be slightly better than Bush, but that's not really saying much, certainly. So I think over time he'll probably get a reasonably good rating, unfortunately.
All right, one more president I'd like to look at, because he's one that a lot of libertarians will pick out. If they don't pick out Van Buren, they'll pick out Grover Cleveland. And you also identified Grover Cleveland. So what are libertarians seeing in Grover Cleveland?
Well, I think he was a very good president. Of course, he had a couple of drawbacks as well, but basically it was for small government. He believed that he was, I think, probably the last president that believed that the executive was supposed to do what the founders had originally intended. And that's what my book tries to really do. You know, I mean, obviously the founders aren't here, but I tried to put myself in the founders' shoes and say, how would they rate these people? And, of course, the original conception was for the executive to have a limited role and simply execute the laws that Congress passed, and Congress was in the driver's seat. And, of course, in the late 1800s, after the Civil War, Congress was in the driver's seat until we got to William McKinley. And, of course, then that's where all the wars started. If you know, there's sort of a correlation. Once you get into the 20th century, you have McKinley, Wilson, Teddy Roosevelt, FDR, that sort of thing. We go down the road to war, whereas Grover Cleveland tried to have a restrained executive. He felt he was just supposed to execute the laws that Congress passed, and that was a very narrow view, and that's really what the founders had envisioned. They made the executive, even in foreign policy, they gave most of the powers in national security, they gave most of the powers to the Congress. And, of course, Grover Cleveland abided by that, and he was pretty much a free market person. And at that time, and that was the end of the Democrats' small government. When he left office, we saw the Democratic Party move to also be a big government party, which the Republican Party already was, I would argue. And then we got Woodrow Wilson in the Democratic Party, who was, of course, you know, for activist government, and the Democratic Party flipped into the big government sector, where it's been all ever since. So we've had two big government parties, and with the exception of Harding and Coolidge, I think the Republicans have always been a big government party, in my view.
Well, the book is called Recarving Rushmore, Ranking the Presidents on Peace, Prosperity, and Liberty. I want to strongly suggest that my listeners look into it, because it's such a wonderful reference to have if you don't go through it page by page, although you should do that too, because you get a biography of every president from the point of view of where that president stood on peace, prosperity, and liberty. What were the consequences of what this person did? What were the things that this person did? Very, very useful book. It's a project that somebody had been needing to do for many years, but most of us were too lazy to do it. And then Ivan Elon came along and did it for us with Recarving Rushmore. Thanks so much for doing this and for your time with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
All right, everybody, a couple quick things to let you know about. I want to fill you in on who the guests are going to be over the course of the week here. I think you'll enjoy them. Before we do that, I want to remind you guys that you really, really are helping me out as I'm making this program. Every time you have something to buy on Amazon, just try and remember to go to TomWoodsRadio.com or TomWoods.com and enter Amazon through the widget there. And at no cost to you, you help us pay our bills. You won't be able to see that widget if you have an ad blocker or sometimes on Chrome. But otherwise, you'll be able to enter Amazon through there, and it really, really helps us out. I sure appreciate that. I also want to thank you guys for subscribing on iTunes and Stitcher, for spreading the word about the program. I mean, word of mouth is pretty much all I've got. And so far, word of mouth has gotten us pretty far in terms of where we are on iTunes and so on. So I really owe that to you guys. I really, really appreciate it. So let's talk about what's coming up this week. Of course, tomorrow, if you recall, we've got our 100th episode. Can you believe that? 100 episodes of this program. So that's coming up tomorrow. And of course, our special guest is Judge Andrew Napolitano. All the questions I ask him came from you guys, primarily on Facebook. So make sure you're following me on Facebook or liking my page on Facebook. It's facebook.com/Thomas E. Woods. Don't look for me as Tom Woods on Facebook. I'm on Facebook, unfortunately, as Thomas E. Woods Jr. So who's coming up on the rest of the week? We got the judge on Tuesday, then Wednesday. Now, by the way, I reserve the right to shuffle these people around at different days, but this is roughly how it's going to work. We're going to have Michael Humer on, who's a professor of philosophy at the University of Colorado at Boulder. And he's a big-time libertarian, and he has a very, very important new-ish book out, The Problem of Political Authority, An Examination of the Right to Coerce and the Duty to Obey. It is quite a hard-hitting book, very interesting. it is not reliant so much on the non-aggression principles. It's not going to be the same presentation of the same material. It takes a different tack on this stuff and basically concludes with libertarian anarchism, a defense of that. So this will be quite interesting, and I know you're going to enjoy hearing that. Then later this week, Eric Voorhees is going to come back on and tell us what in the world is going on with Bitcoin. Good grief. Is this the beginning of the end or the end of the beginning? Voorhees will be here to tell us what is really going on. And then finally, Bill Kaufman. Now, if you guys don't know Bill Kaufman, I can't tell you what a treat you are in for. Bill Kaufman is a screenwriter of that movie Copperhead from last year. He's the author of many books. He's one of my favorite writers of all time. And I think he had the best line at Ron Paul's rally for the Republic in 2008. When he was talking about Ron Paul up on the debate stage with all the other Republican candidates. And Bill was saying, when you looked at Ron Paul up there, he said it was as if he was from another time and place, which in a certain sense he was. Ron Paul is from 1776 and they're from 1984. Oh, I love that line. So we'll talk to Bill later this week about decentralizing movements, the split state movements going on around the country, and whatever kinds of tangents he and I go off on, because these are always fun. So that's the program for the rest of the week. Make sure you tune in. Don't miss an episode. Judge Napolitano tomorrow. Help me spread the word. We'll see you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.